Case number 08-5088 et al. Neelan Cohen, appellant versus United States of America. Mr. Sinkar for appellants Virginia Sloan et al. Mr. Bowen for appellant Neelan Cohen. And Ms. Del Sol for the appellee.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Sinkar. First, I want to thank the court for granting our motion for 20 minutes today. We have divided up our time. I'm taking 12 minutes, and with the court's permission, I'm one of the counsel on the Sloan case. I will be addressing the APA issues, and my colleague, Mr. Bowen, who's one of the counsel on the Cohen case, will be addressing the Cohen letter decision question and the Anti-Injunction Act, Declaratory Judgment Act issues, and then he will be doing rebuttal for all of us. So I will be using my full 12 minutes with no rebuttal in there. With that, I will proceed. Your Honors, we come actually with a fairly narrow issue to this court. We have a federal excise tax on long-distance telephones that has been understood now to be illegal for a period of time. We represent individuals and putative class members who have been injured by that fact. The district court recognized that fact. We have a right to have our money back that was illegally exacted. The government put in place a special procedure for getting those refunds, and we have challenged that as unlawful and unconstitutional.
Are you still seeking a refund in this litigation?
Well, right now, Your Honor, we're focusing on the procedure. So,
is that a yes or a no?
No. I would think not, because if we get the procedure, we'll get a refund.
Then, if you're not seeking money,
well, we are, Your Honor. But the issue before us right now concerns the refund procedure, which is a basic threshold we have to go for. So we are entitled to a refund. We are seeking it, but the question before us now that has stopped us from getting to the merits is this question of the procedures by which you claim a refund. So, yes, of course, we are seeking a refund at the end of the day.
Not in this litigation.
Yes, in this litigation, I would say.
Well, you just said no.
I know. I said no, but I, as we were talking, I was thinking as I was talking, Your Honor, which is always probably a bad thing to do, because so much of our energies over the last several months have been focused on just the procedure. In our complaint, we sought a refund, and we challenged the refund procedure. The court accepted the government's argument that the current refund procedure or some procedure must be complied with before it would have subject matter jurisdiction over our claim for that the procedures need to be correct and claim for money. So the district court would have the option, in our view, of adjudicating our substantive claim for the money, or simply, and we think, frankly, this is the most effective thing, adjudicate our claim that the IRS's procedures are unlawful and then send it back to the agency to do it right.
Do you agree that Notice 2006-50 is a regulation of the Secretary?
I think it has the effect of being a rule in the sense that it has a legal impact, Your Honor. I don't think we have to go so far as we have argued that it is a rule and should have been done in notice and comment rulemaking.
Right.
But I don't think that's essential to the legal flaw.
Well, what I'm trying to figure out is whether your challenge to the procedure or to the regime mm-hmm. set up by Notice 2006-50 has to be brought. You first have to follow the procedure and then bring it in a refund action as opposed to a freestanding APA claim. Because 7422, the statute, seems to suggest, along with all the tax precedents that are out there in the jurisprudence, that the way to do this is to first follow the procedures the IRS has set up and then bring a refund claim. And if you want to say the procedures or the substance of the rule or improper, you do it together with your refund action. And here, so that's laying the groundwork. And here, my concern is no one ever followed none of your clients ever filed the proper form, right?
Well, one tried. Mr. Krasny did file a...
He wanted refunds on behalf of the whole country, so the IRS naturally...
Well, no, he also mentioned what his own would be. Right. But the problem is remember, and your question really goes, I think, to the first thing you were asking me, obviously, Your Honor, and that's this dichotomy with the nature of the claims in our case.
Right.
And so I'm with you, and I would say this. What we have, remember, with our excise taxes, our folks are not the people who collect the taxes. We have no duty to keep track of documentation. Like any of us who pay income taxes, we have that duty, and we keep records and so forth. So the facts here are that this procedure was an absolute barrier for millions of people to try to seek a refund. So, Your Honor, we would say that, and we cited Berry versus Barkin.
Why is it a barrier for your clients?
Because
they could have filed the form 8913 like millions of people did.
Well,
and then they could have, if they thought that the regime set up was under-inclusive because it didn't go back to July 02, for example, which I understand to be one of your claims, they could have brought the refund action together with your argument that the regime set up by the IRS didn't sufficiently compensate them. They didn't file the 8913, even though it's clear as day, and your clients understand that they were supposed to file the 8913.
Right, Your Honor, but the problem is that your question, I think, has buried within it a substantive factual conclusion that hasn't been litigated.
Okay.
And that has to do with the issue of whether we could comply with it. I mean, we have alleged that we don't have the records, we don't have the information to provide the kind of detail that these forms require. Now, we didn't even get a chance to adjudicate that below. That's why I was focusing so much on the procedure.
Right.
We have alleged that we can't do what you just said, why can't you do? And the district court below didn't even address that, and I don't think it would be proper for this court to...
Let me probe that. There's a line on the 1040, right? And then you're supposed to file the 8913 if you're claiming more than the standard amount, right? That's what the IRS said.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And couldn't you file the 8913 and say we're claiming a refund for more than we have records for, and we're going to challenge the records requirement?
Well, you could, Your Honor, but based on how we understand how the IRS treats those things is that they reject them. And first of all...
Right, they'll reject them, and then you file refund action in court. Right.
Or they don't process them at all. I mean, Your Honor,
Well, then you have, after 6 months, you can file the refund action in court.
That's true, but I guess it seems to me that the basic issue is that we have not only our individual plaintiffs here, but we have our putative class on whom we're bringing this case. Right now, we moved for class certification, we didn't get there. And we contend and have alleged that lots of people wouldn't even be aware of the requirement that you use the 1040 this way and so forth, so they couldn't even have been as smart as you are to do that. Second of all, part of what we've also explicitly...
It's 100 million people managed to navigate the process, right?
But a lot more didn't. A lot more. In fact, this is exactly the point, Your Honor, is that the people who did navigate this are the people who have gone to college, are in large corporations and so forth.
There were a lot of non-filers who did this.
Yeah, but the thing is, in terms of what we know at this point about that, a lot of the non-filers, by definition, are people with lower income, they're seniors and so forth, so they're going to be the folks who are most naturally going to be confused and put at a disadvantage, so that this would not be, under the law, a meaningful way of getting their money back. I mean, that's the standard. Clear, certain, and meaningful. That's what the Supreme Court has said. But if
not to belabor this, but...
No, I do want to get back. Go ahead, Your Honor.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how to take into account the class, your putative class in this case, and I'm not sure how to take that into account, because your clients, the named plaintiffs, certainly could have filed the 8913 because they're aware of it.
That's quite true, but the point is that we do represent more people than that, at least in our putative class, and I would say that we're still, even the judgment that our guys could have done that, Your Honor, gets into issues that we never had a chance to litigate below. And so with respect, Your Honor, I would say, you know, if you are a district judge, come on down and we'll litigate that in front of you. But because we have this procedure that was a barrier to at least millions of the class we'd like to represent, I would say we should have a chance to adjudicate the questions that you're asking. Okay, I don't think...
The question I'd like to ask,
yes, Your Honor,
actually, which is just on that point. You argue that the notice is unlawful for various APA-related reasons.
Yes, Your Honor. Right?
And if you were to win on that point and the agency were and the service were required to issue a new notice, that would give you a new opportunity, whether you had an opportunity before or not, that would give you a new opportunity to file for a refund. And if it were then rejected, you could then go to court, and if it weren't rejected, you could get your money, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the only issue that I understand before us on this point is whether you should have a right to argue about whether the notice is arbitrary or capricious or without notice and comment, or whether that's foreclosed because it's a policy statement. That's the only thing that the district court decided.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. That's why my introduction was that this is a narrow question.
So the district court could say, well, you should have filed a notice in order to get the refund, regardless of whether I'm going to give you a new one, a new kind of notice or not, or anything else. But the only issue that we have before us is a challenge, I take it, to what you claim should be a rulemaking. And you may have some claims about your own money and refunds below, but
yes.
I don't see those as being before us here.
You're absolutely right. My confused give and take with Judge Kavanaugh at the beginning was really that what's before this court is simply that. But if I
now let me ask and start with a question though that Judge Kavanaugh asked, which
yeah.
is, do you in on the on that exhaustion question, which is not before, although the exhaustion question is before us in a way with Mr. Cohn,
yes.
with respect to you, and I guess maybe I shouldn't ask this also because this is a curiosity question about what might happen in the district court, is your position that, well, it's not unrelated, is your position that that one of the reasons why the notice that was issued by the IRS is not a policy statement, is that it is a regulation of the Secretary established in pursuant under 74222A. And therefore, it does in a way have the force of law that somebody would not be able to pursue a suit unless they had complied with that regulation.
The short answer is yes, Your Honor, because
that's what makes it not some discretionary decision by the agency, not something that matters whether the agency grants refunds or not, but it's a procedural requirement established by a statute, which is a hurdle to anybody proceeding thereafter. Is that
yes,
right?
That's exactly, Your Honor. If I may, I know I only have a couple seconds, but I do. There's one point with respect to my dialogue with both of your honors that I want you to keep in mind, if I could. When we get, if we do get back to the district court on the factual questions of what you have to do, remember, consistent with perfection is not the goal here. So that's important to understand. But the understanding is that the judgment of what is meaningful and what an agency has to do is a comparative judgment. What are the other alternatives? You know, if there are no other alternatives except X, and it puts a big burden on a private party, then the calculus of what's meaningful and what's reasonably certain under the law.
If I were you, I'd preserve some of your time rather than arguing something that you may have to argue to the district court in order to argue something to us.
Well, Your Honor, my only simple point is that the telephone companies, under the statutes and so forth, are the collectors, and they're the gorilla here in the living room that can provide the mechanism. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bowen.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Bowen. I'm going to try to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal with the court's permission. My purpose here in this principal argument is to address the Anti-Injunction Act issue and the right to that the government raised in its brief in this court and the right to sue issue that is specific to Neelan Cohen's case. My principal objective is to respond to questions or concerns that the court may have on those issues. However, there is a very provocative, unifying theme tying those two issues together, running through them, that I would like to discuss. Lawyers always say
you can find a provocative theme in an IRS case. You are one very good litigator.
Your Honor, I've been accused of creativity, and I've almost always found that a prelude to disaster, so I'll try to avoid that this time. The provocative theme I have found is that on both of these issues, the government's position depends upon convincing this court that words do not mean what they say, words in statutes, words in notices. That the operative language in the Anti-Injunction Act, assessment and collection of taxes, the government says actually has a vastly broader meaning than that, whereas the operative term in the IRS, the Internal Revenue Code provision, decision, actually has an artificially narrow meaning. It is much narrower than decision as it is used in ordinary discourse. And finally, that the language in the notice the IRS sent to Mr. Cohen on January the 4th, 2006, has a meaning that bears no relationship whatever to the words that the IRS chose to put into that notice. The appellants in this case are in the happy position of contending to the contrary, that the words mean what they say, that they have the meaning in context that they would have in ordinary discourse, that assessment and collection of taxes means revenue coming in to the government, not disgorgement of money that the government admits now it never had the right to secure in the first place, that is completely unrelated to whether the government gets money and has nothing to do with it. That decision means a conclusion reached after a process of deliberation and formally announced, and not simply one particular kind of decision or decision of one particular type. And finally, that the words "we are unable to process your claim," as the cognate words in the Gervasio case were held to mean exactly what any intelligent, ordinary citizen and taxpayer getting that message would understand them to mean, which is, you ain't getting your money, forget about it. The anomalous position, as I see it, that the government has taken in this area is perversely revealing. When lawyers run away from words, that generally means they think those words, if taken in their literal denotation, are fatal to their position. And when those words appear in statutes and informal notices, they are generally right. And so I suggest to the court that the meaning of these words in the statute should be taken as exactly what the terms suggest, and that straining to find some artificial meaning for those terms is an error. It is not a strict construction of anything. It is a perverse misconstruction of the statute. The policy rationales the government has identified are indeed weighty. We embrace them. We have no problem with them at all. It is very important for the government to collect money and to be able to run and to function. However, that simply has nothing to do with this case. This case hasn't been about the government assessing and collecting taxes since May of 2006, when the government came out with its hands up and said, "You're right, you got us, we don't have a right to collect the money." This case isn't about Mr. Cohen jumping the gun and suing before the government had a chance to think things over and decide what it was going to do. It did think things over. It did decide what it was going to do. It sent him a formal notice saying what it was going to do. It had made its decision.
I thought it was a non-decision.
I'm sorry?
Oh, it was a non-decision.
Well, Your Honor, I think that that is not the way Mr. Cohen would have understood it, and I don't think that's the actual...
Use the usual words of decisions.
But the courts have held repeatedly, Your Honor, that there are no magic words. They use words
words have meaning, right?
That's the word, words and do have meaning, and the words "unable to process your claim," like the cognate words in the Gervasio case, mean you aren't getting your money.
The next sentence has to be read as the next sentence, doesn't it?
It does indeed, Your Honor.
Because we have to look at all the words.
Indeed, we must look at all the words.
The words say additional information will be provided as it is received.
Right, and that is an information that the government is going to get information to him, and leaving completely a speculation what that information might be, but that does not suggest...
Well, so you say, but you told us to pay very careful attention to the words. I'm having difficulty seeing this as clearly... these words being clearly in your favor.
Your Honor, the question is what message do those words communicate to Mr. Cohen? The government says the message those words communicated to Mr. Cohen was, we're not giving you your money now, but we might change our mind later on depending on some things that happen.
Yeah.
That cannot be taken from that language.
Be taken from that language?
No, there is nothing in that.
Well, certainly Mr. Cohen knew what the litigation was about, right?
I should hope so, Your Honor, yes.
So and obviously, depending on which way the litigation came out, they would process the claim or they wouldn't. Isn't that right?
Your Honor, that's not what the notice says. That is emphatically not what it says.
I didn't say that's what it said, but he knows what the litigation is about. He knows if the IRS loses litigation, they may have to process the claim. If they win the litigation, they may not have to process the claim.
That would be speculative on his part.
Why? Why? Isn't the purpose of the litigation to force them to process
the IRS had been losing litigation for months, court after court after court, and it had hardened its position. It had said, we keep losing.
What if it was the Supreme Court says the subject is in litigation? You think he should assume that even if the Supreme Court said you have to pay, that they wouldn't?
I think that if a million things could have happened if Congress had passed a law saying pay the money. We'll give you information about that. But that
they didn't say that. They said the tax is currently a subject in litigation and additional information will be provided as it's received.
I agree with that, Your Honor. That is exactly what it says. The question is, should Mr. Cohen have understood that as meaning if we lose a few more cases to go along with the cases we've been losing for months, we're going to look at this again.
There's a deadline, right? The 6 months would have, at some point, 6 months would have passed, and then you could have filed suit regardless.
Right, and if the government were saying, we just want you to wait for the 6 months, it didn't have to say anything to it.
I think what this is saying is there may be additional litigation and changes soon.
Your Honor, I suggest that, with all respect, that putting the burden of sophisticated deconstruction and exegesis on a taxpayer at that level of analysis is an excessive burden to be imposed.
What happened in the circuits in which the IRS lost?
In the first circuit in which it lost, the IRS responded by issuing a formal notice saying, we're not going to change our ways. We're going to keep on clicking the tax.
Even for citizens in that?
That is correct. That's exactly right. That's what they said.
And what was the response to litigants having received a positive result from the court? Did they try to get an injunction against the service?
No, Your Honor. My understanding is that the litigants who had been successful in those courts entered into negotiations with the IRS and were quietly granted relief by the IRS.
That was true in each of the circuits?
I'm off the record at this point, Your Honor. I don't know, but that's my understanding. This is hearsay. Okay. I would be happy to respond to any further questions the court has. I would like to reserve some time, if I might, for rebuttal.
You got about 11 seconds left.
I'll do my best, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ellen Dulsol, and I represent the United States. I'd like to suggest that there's a different provocative theme in this tax case, and that is that Congress has set up a very specifically delineated statutory scheme for seeking relief in tax cases, and the Supreme Court's repeatedly upheld that scheme as one that where the relief is designed to be sought through refund suits, but the refund suits have to comply with a series of statutory prerequisites. And the Supreme Court, very recently in the Clintwood Elkhorn Mining case, clarified that Section 7422, which provides a limited waiver of sovereign immunity, has to be strictly construed, and it's very emphatic that all the prerequisites set forth in the code and its regulations have to be met.
We're not trying to construe 7422. We're trying to construe this letter at JA 422.
Well, I think the part of that Supreme Court precedent is that terms like decision have to be strictly construed in favor of the government because they are part of a waiver of sovereign immunity. And I think here, with regard to Cohen's refund claim, the two letters he relies on certainly don't constitute a decision within any reasonable meaning of that word. I mean, the first letter says the matter is in litigation.
I think you got it with the first letter.
Okay, all right.
I'm not arguing about it.
And the second letter actually says that the matter is the subject of litigation and that additional information will be forthcoming. And that on its face, I think, could tell any reasonable person that there is a possibility that the IRS will take a different tact on this. And in fact, taxpayer's attorney was sufficiently involved in this issue that he was talking to the BNA Daily Tax Report on this, and it's in the record at page 234 of the joint appendix, and he stated that letter neither granted nor denied the refund claim and that the matter was the subject of litigation. And I think in that
circumstance, Mr. Cohn's?
That's Mr. Bowen's statement, and it's in the record in the joint appendix at page 234. And I think in light of that, this is certainly a situation where the letter clearly communicated that there was a possibility of a future decision. And all that Mr. Cohen had to do to have a prior claim was wait an additional couple of months, and the 6 months would have expired, and he could have had a valid refund claim. And he elected not to do that. And having done so, he fails to satisfy the jurisdictional prerequisites. And I think this court's sister circuit in the AG Re-Steel case, which is from the Sixth Circuit, cited in our briefs, says that a decision means there has to be allowance or disallowance of a claim. And there are a vast number of other cases that so hold. I think the only one that doesn't talk about a specific allowance or disallowance is the Gervasio case, where the claim had actually been returned to the taxpayer so that the court found that the IRS couldn't have possibly acted on it. And that case predates a lot of the Supreme Court cases that I discussed, like Clint Wood and the Brokamp case, that say that the statute has to be strictly construed.
Could I ask about why you think this is a policy statement?
On the Administrative Procedure Act, Your Honor?
Yes.
Your Honor, nothing in first of all, notice 2650 wasn't the subject of notice and comment rulemaking. It wasn't a regulation. Well,
that wasn't even a ruling.
That
could be the problem, rather.
But I think what that notice did is it left in place the entire statutory scheme under Section 6511, 6532, and 7422
Let me play out the argument, and you tell me what's wrong with it. Okay, so 7422A says no suit or proceeding shall be maintained in any court until a claim for refund has been duly filed with the Secretary according to the provisions of law and the regulations of the Secretary established and pursuant thereof. Now, is this seems like a regulation established by the Secretary as to how you file a claim.
Well, first of all, I think it was established by the IRS. It was a notice. Are you talking about notice 2650? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
That notice was simply a statement by the IRS about making an offer to taxpayers to get their claim processed.
That's a no to Judge Garland's question?
Pardon me? It's not a regulation. It's not a ruling.
Not a regulation just because you didn't go through notice and comment?
Well, it's also a regulation because if a taxpayer had gone ahead with the statutory scheme that Congress provided and filed
on what form?
If they used any other form, the forms that would have existed without the notice.
What form?
Form 843 or 8849?
I told you not to do
it
this.
It clearly says don't use that.
It says a request for this credit or refund on any other form, such as a form 720, 843, or 8849 will not be processed by the service.
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to realize that the statutory scheme doesn't require the service to process claims. It gives it discretion to process claims or not process them.
That's a different question than the question of when you can bring a lawsuit under 7422A. Now,
well,
let me just see if I understand. Is the service's position that if a taxpayer takes a bubblegum wrapper and writes out on the back of the bubblegum wrapper, I want a refund, and mails it in, that when they then file suit, you will not claim that they have failed to exhaust it under 7422A?
Well, I think a bubblegum wrapper would be very difficult to use to fulfill the regulatory requirements, the requirements that are actually in regulations, of setting forth the basis of the claim and the amount of the claim and
what
all those details.
They put all that stuff on the bubblegum wrapper?
Many courts have held that sort of informal refund claim is sufficient to bring suit under Section 7422.
So
and I think certainly the regulations contemplate Form 843, and if that had been used, the service would have been bound, would have been forced to accept the claim.
I think Judge Brown was asking you, how can you say 843 is okay when it says that a request under using that form will not be processed?
Well, the service doesn't have an obligation under the statutory scheme to process a refund claim. The Supreme Court explained in the Felt Tarrant manufacturing case and in Brokamp that the purpose of the administrative refund claim system is to make a workable tax system where the IRS has notice of the claims that are coming up against it and a chance to process
them. So do you have a regulation that says if you don't want us to process your claim, file it on this form? And if you want us to process your claim, file it on that form?
Well, I think if you file anything with the IRS, if you file something using the 843, which the regulation refers to, or you use the 8849, which the 843 referred you to for excise taxes, the service would have accepted those. And
how do we know that?
Accepted when they have said to the taxpayer, we will not accept it.
No, they didn't say it wouldn't count as a refund claim.
Processed.
They said it would not be processed by the IRS administratively. They did not say that it would not count as a refund claim for purposes of bringing suit, and I think under the regulations it would have. The IRS, under Heckler v. Cheney and the Brokamp and Felt-Tarrant Manufacturing cases, it has this process of having administrative discretion in order to determine how to process claims and how to manage these claims. And this was a situation where the IRS was being hit with a situation where, because of the law that had very quickly come down in the several cases we were litigating, holding that this tax could no longer be collected, it was facing a large volume of refund claims, potentially from every taxpayer in America who had a telephone.
How would a taxpayer get to court on the claim that the period for the refund should have gone back to July 2002 rather than starting with May 2003?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think there would be a valid claim for an earlier period because the statute of limitations had expired.
Okay, but how would you get to court to make that argument?
Well, I think you'd have to file a refund claim, and then if it wasn't acted on within 6 months, you could file suit. But I don't think the argument that there was a gap in the statute of limitations was raised in the Radio Shack case that was recently argued before the Federal Circuit.
And the same,
and that's not an argument that has been
made. How about if you wanted to make an argument that the regime set up by the IRS undercompensated me because it required me to produce telephone records that no one reasonably had, how would you make that argument?
Well, I think, first of all, the IRS went to great lengths to accommodate taxpayers. It provided, with a notice, it provided a very easy method.
I know. I'm just focused on my question.
And if the issue was that this wasn't an adequate method, the method actually provided a safe harbor provision. So if you didn't have your records,
right,
you could go back.
But suppose someone, and I'm not talking about a class now, just one individual taxpayer, says to the IRS, I don't have the records, but this standard amount that you set forth, which is all well and good, is going to undercompensate me.
Well, I think that would to say that the taxpayers could get relief in that situation without their records would really undercut a whole.
How would you get to court? Can you get to court?
Oh, you could file a refund claim, and when it was either rejected or not acted on, you could go to court. But I think you wouldn't prevail in that because that would undercut the whole concept that you have to substantiate your records, and the tax code generally, very broadly, requires.
I just want to make sure that I understand because there was the reply brief suggested that the IRS's position was that you could never get to court to challenge some of these things. And I understood you to be saying, and I think you're confirming, that you can get to court to challenge
right.
these substantive problems with the regime set up.
Certainly, Your Honor, if you file a refund claim.
Other than it's hard to get to court to say other people didn't have notice of this.
I think that's true, Your Honor. And I think what the IRS did with Notice 2006-50 is do its best with a very difficult, large administration problem to give notice to people that this was an issue and to provide a streamlined, easy way for them to get a refund in an amount that was either an average, sort of an average safe harbor, or that allowed them just to attach to their return a return.
That sounds like an argument on the merits about whether what you did was arbitrary and capricious, not about whether or not it was a policy or not. We haven't gotten to that question yet.
Well, I think what the policy issue really turns on what Congress had set up and what is, you know, Congress had set up a scheme for processing refunds, and the notice nowhere in it says that it is altering that scheme. The scheme Congress set up gave the service discretion to process a claim or not.
Total discretion?
You're saying that you aren't bound, in other words, the taxpayer is not bound. You're saying that even though this language sounds very mandatory, taxpayers could do something else if they chose, and they could still get into court. But what about on the other end of this? Isn't the IRS bound by what it said now? I mean,
yes. I mean, I think if somebody filed a refund claim in the form that the notice called for, that had all the requisite information called for by the notice, the IRS was saying, we're going to grant those claims.
Well, if the agency is bound, then why isn't that?
Well, I think it's more in the nature of
a policy statement.
It's more in the nature of an offer or an agreement to resolve these claims in this way. And I don't think, I think that the agency would have done it, but I think certainly if they didn't, then that we would be in court, litigating that issue, and the taxpayer could file a refund suit and get a relief in court. But I do think there is discretion for the agency to decide whether or not to process claims. In fact, I think it would have been okay for them
to say. Usually in the cases that the policy statement case is usually in the document in question, it says that. It says the agency has some discretion. We're going to do it this way. This is one way. There's all sorts of weasel words
Usually
in there.
The agency is not bound by any things. This creates no rights
but
for any party.
This thing doesn't...
You have answered, Judge Brown, that this does create a right for the parties if they do follow the rules.
Well, I think the IRS would have honored it, certainly.
And it actually creates a hurdle. If you don't follow the rules, the IRS won't process it.
Well, except for that you might file, without this notice, the IRS would probably have been inundated by claims.
After this notice is in effect, and you, as Judge Brown said at the beginning, and then you file the wrong form, the IRS won't process it because of what's laid out in the notice, correct?
The IRS made a decision that it wasn't going to process the other return.
It would process it if you did it on the 1040 and with the 8913. It's not going to process it if it's on the 843 or some other form.
But the IRS could have made a decision not to process any of the model. It had discretion.
Well, it could have, but it had discretion before the notice. But after the notice came out, that purported to bind both the IRS
and... Well, it was simply informational regarding how it intended to...
I don't see how that's reasonable for anyone to think that.
And I think, Your Honor, even if there were... If this could arise to more than a policy statement here, and I don't think it can. I mean, this is not a rulemaking in any of the sense that a revenue ruling or even a revenue procedure goes through in terms of the levels of review. It is something that
$100 million taxpayers followed this.
And they got their refunds.
Right, because it set out clear rules for what you needed to do.
Well, but anyone who didn't follow this was not aggrieved because they didn't lose anything that they didn't already have. I mean, they were in the same position.
They had to file a lawsuit to get it.
Well, but they did beforehand anyway. I mean, they had to go through that process anyway. The IRS, there was no guarantee that the IRS was going to process their refund claim anyway. I mean, really the beef here is with the system that Congress set up.
The IRS is just claiming we can do anything we want regardless of what regulations we put out there, which is an interesting position.
Well, no, I don't think that's the IRS's position at all. I mean, the position is we're making an offer to resolve this very simply and in a streamlined way, and we're saying if you do this, we're going to grant these refund claims, and that they were just stating as a policy matter how they were stating what their practice was going to be about how they were going to handle the refund claims, but any taxpayer could still proceed.
It might be a policy statement if they were still processing them under the old forms, but said, here's a simplified way to do it under the 1040 and the 8913. Maybe then. But they were saying, not only were they saying, here's one way to do it, they're saying, and we're not going to allow you to do it any other way.
Well, that's they didn't say bit. You couldn't file them, and they didn't
well,
say you couldn't bring a refund
suit. We're not going to process them.
But I mean, I think that's the reality is with this sort of administrative situation where so many claims were going to be coming in that it just wasn't possible to process them on separate forms. So they came up with this way of if you put it on your return, which we already have to process, and that'll make it more streamlined and simpler for everybody, then we're going to process those. And that was just a matter of how they in practice were going to exercise their discretion. And there was nothing that prevented the taxpayers from filing a form. The taxpayers, the rule doesn't say anything about you can't file a return.
Can I ask you
file
something question?
The way the regulations
this
say you can.
All a little bit off topic, but assume you're wrong on this and assume it is a regulation. Okay? Notice 2006-50 is a regulation, a rule. Can it be challenged in a freestanding APA challenge on your judgment, or does it need to be challenged under 7422 together with a refund claim, or does the department have no position on that?
I think it could not be challenged as a freestanding APA claim because I think the district court should have held that there was no jurisdiction here under the Anti-Injunction Act because the Anti-Injunction Act and the Declaratory Judgment Act limit the court's jurisdiction where there's a case involving a tax controversy.
But that's the only bar.
Well, that and the fact that there wouldn't be a claim on the merits because the taxpayers here weren't aggrieved.
That's a merits court.
Right.
So the substantive challenge to the regulation, the regulation's arbitrary and capricious. I want to make that challenge as a taxpayer. Can I just bring that challenge?
Well, I don't think you can under the Administrative Procedure Act because, I mean, first of all, the courts have been very adamant that when it's really an end run to a tax refund, which is what Mr. Sinkar conceded this, they're ultimately trying to get here, that those claims can't be brought under the Administrative
Procedure Act. No regulation issued by the IRS can be challenged under the Administrative Procedure Act? We all are going to have something to do with taxes, I assume.
I think for I think generally yes. I mean, the only exception I would say is one that doesn't actually ultimately affect the tax collection. If there was one regulation in the food services case that this court found pertained only to data collection, but I think here what they're seeking is a refund of taxes that affects the revenue collected. Under the Supreme Court's holding in Bob Jones University, that's within the scope of the Anti-Injunction Act, and the Declaratory Judgment Act's language is very broad. It says any tax controversy
that wouldn't preclude challenging it. It would just require to be challenged together with the refund claim, the refund suit.
Right. You could bring a refund suit and challenge the regulation in a refund
and
suit.
And in the refund suit, you could also argue that the
regulation,
that it's arbitrary and capricious not to allow me to recover back to July 2002. It's arbitrary and capricious.
Right. Right. And certainly many cases, there are many tax cases.
I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. I mean, in the refund suit, you could bring that.
I mean, I've certainly litigated many refund suits where people challenge regulations as invalid.
Invalid on what grounds?
Any variety of grounds. I mean, either because it didn't, go through the proper procedures to promulgate the regulation, or because it was unconstitutional, or whatever reasons there might be.
Are there no cases where no APA challenges to any IRS regulation that you know of?
There were a couple of cases, cited in our brief. The investment annuity case cited in our brief involved a challenge to an IRS ruling.
A straight APA, not in the context. Bob Jones, petitioner was trying to challenge a specific revocation.
Revocation of a ruling.
Yes, treating. But I'm talking about, in the normal way we think of APA cases, an agency, the EPA, issues a rule about clean air, and a whole bunch of people bring a lawsuit challenging under the Administrative Procedure Act as arbitrary and capricious. That's it. Nothing else. Not asking for money, not asking for revocation, not asking for an injunction, just asking for a holding that the decision was arbitrary and capricious.
I think our position was that can't happen in a tax case under the Bob Jones University.
But Bob Jones is only about revocation. That was a case where an individual school actually was challenging the revocation.
They were challenging revocation of a ruling with respect to them, but there wasn't actually an assessment or collection of tax here. But because the ruling would, in effect, have an impact on the tax of that tax liability of that taxpayer and of others who might have been making charitable donations to that entity, the court said that was in connection with the assessment and collection of taxes.
They wanted it revoked before taxes were assessed or collected from them.
It wasn't
a case about refunds.
Yeah, I do think, Your Honor, that most of the Anti-Injunction Act cases and Declaratory Judgment Act cases involving taxes have arisen in the context of the pre-collection context, because people are trying to stop collection and people are more inclined to bring refund suits after their money's been taken. But I think that the concept is the same. If you can take away the money, it still affects the collection of tax.
That's just the concept, right? I thought you were relying also on the language of 7422. Am I not right?
I think it
sets up a similar type of regime
For obtaining refunds.
Maybe not. That's what I was trying to figure out with some of my questions.
Well, I think both between the Bob Jones case and the Anti-Injunction Act issue and the Supreme Court cases on 7422, it makes clear that in the refund context, what Congress was trying to set up was a regime where you have to wait till the refund stage, and then you have to seek relief in the refund context, and to do so you have to comply with the requirements of the statutory scheme pertaining to refunds. That's really the theme of this case.
To go back to the provocative theme of your opponent, 7422 says, no suit or proceeding shall be maintained for the recovery of any internal revenue tax. And if we're talking just about the, so that they may lose their other part of this, but the claim with respect to the APA is not for the recovery of any internal revenue tax.
Well, I think, what Mr. Sinkar was saying is that it ultimately is.
Well, then he'll lose that part, and then he'll go away happy that he's made IRS law, but sad that he put no money in anybody's pocket.
But I think the Supreme Court precedents on the Anti-Injunction Act are...
Which ones?
I think Bob Jones talks broadly about the purpose being to avoid premature judicial interference in tax administration.
We have actual words that you have to deal with. No suit for the purpose of restraining the assessment or collection of any tax.
I think if it's a suit to make you give back the money that's already been collected, it is a suit that restrains collection. And I think the Declaratory Judgment Act broadly
how is that true when the IRS has already conceded they're not entitled to it? I mean, there's no decision at issue there.
Well, there is the issue of whether the taxpayer is entitled to recover the tax, and Congress has said if you want to recover the tax, you have to go through these proceedings. I mean, if that were the standard, any time that the IRS was clearly wrong and had lost an issue in other courts, that would mean you didn't have to go through the refund procedures. And I think Congress intended this to be a very strict statutory scheme where every taxpayer had to go through these steps of filing their refund claim, waiting 6 months, and then filing suit under the refund procedures. And that there were, and that
except that here the question of liability has gone away. I mean, the IRS has already conceded that. That's what the safe harbor is, basically, right?
Well, I think for the service to be every notice and every exercise of discretion that the service issues in any kind of publication to be subject to review under the Administrative Procedure Act would be contrary to the cases like Heckler v. Cheney that have said that when there matters an agency discretion, that's something that the courts won't take under judicial review under the Administrative Procedure Act. And that really comes down to the question, to the issue here of whether this is something that's just a matter of how the agency is going to exercise its discretion, which I think this is under the tax code scheme.
How the agency is going to exercise its discretion, I suppose, because, you know, they've said how they want the refund to be done. But is it still a matter of discretion as to whether they're entitled to collect that tax? I mean, could the agency now go back and say, well, we said we were wrong and we're not entitled to the tax and now we change our mind?
Well, I think the courts have resolved that issue, and it's been, you know, resolved by a majority of circuits, and I think that issue has already been resolved in the courts.
That's what I'm saying. That issue isn't there anymore. And in most cases,
a matter of discretion with respect to how the refunds are meted out, and I think that's something that Congress left to the agency's discretion, and therefore, having publicized how they're going to exercise that discretion, should not give rise to an APA action.
We haven't said that the Anti-Injunction Act applies to everything relating to taxes, have we?
I'm sorry, this court, you mean?
Yes.
Well, I think the statements of this court have varied to some...
It's not a statements question, it's a holdings question.
Well, I think this court has held that it applies to things like in the investment annuity case to a ruling of the IRS. I think that was and I think, you know, in other cases, in the Murphy case, for example, that's cited in our briefs, the court said it applies to all tax controversies. In the Wright versus Egan case that the taxpayers cite, the court suggested it has a narrower construction, but that was a footnote point in a case that was reversed by the Supreme Court on other grounds, on standing grounds, so the Supreme Court never reached the court's characterization in that case. So I think, you know, I think it's an area where this court's law has not been crystal clear regarding what its scope is, but I think there certainly are cases in this court that support the government's position, and definitely the Supreme Court cases that have applied a broad construction to the statutory language and have emphasized that the purpose
is dictum in the sense that they're not on the subject we're talking about. These are all the cases you're talking about are ones that are actually about assessment. So we have some cases like Eastern Kentucky Welfare Rights where we say that if it's not about assessment, then it's not covered.
Well, I think, first of all, the statute does say assessment or collection, and that case was also vacated.
Assessment or collection. That, and in that case, it was not about either. It was about an exemption from taxation, and we said that, and we allowed an APA challenge in it.
Well, and the Supreme Court, on the other hand, has said where there's a challenge to a ruling that's going to affect the assessment and collection, and ultimately have an effect on the right of the service to keep money, that is something.
Says it the way you just said it.
I think the Bob Jones University case does. I mean, that case involved a ruling where the taxpayer made the very argument that the taxpayers made here, that ruling didn't involve assessment or collection of tax. It just had to do with the corporation's status on the list under 501c3. And the court came back and said, this is broader than just whether the particular case involves assessment or collection. And it said, you know, the purpose of this statute is to, the Anti-Injunction Act is to prevent the courts from having judicial review evaluating these sort of agency statements or rulings ahead of time, but to confine, you know, the purpose is to keep the tax disputes in the refund context. And the refund context provides a forum for taxpayers to seek relief, and I think the Supreme Court over and over again has said that this refund context, you comply with the rules, then you get your refund then court through your refund suit, and that was what the statutory scheme was designed to provide.
What about the food service case?
Well, I think the food service case, I question whether that case drew a correct line there in light of the Bob Jones case, but I think it can be distinguished in that it did.
Bob Jones was specifically about, you know, whether you get an exemption, which then goes to the question of whether taxes are collected. That one was about whether or not they were complying with tip reporting, right?
Well, I'm sorry, the food service was about the tip rulings, yes. But the particular ruling that the food service case held was not barred by the Anti-Injunction Act actually just dealt with data collection, and the court concluded, I believe, that it didn't go directly to the issue of tax collection. And there were a number of other rulings in that case that actually were held to be rulings that couldn't proceed under the Anti-Injunction Act.
Okay, any further questions?
There are no further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay, let's see. I believe that you've run out of time. Is that right?
We have 11 seconds remaining.
11 seconds remaining, all right. We'll give you a little bit more than that. Go ahead.
I'm at the court's indulgence. I have 4 points I'd like to make.
Before you answer those four points, what's your answer to the Anti-Injunction Act claim?
That was one of the 4 points, and my answer is that if the Bob Jones University had won in that case, the United States government would have gotten less tax revenue, and that was why Bob Jones University lost. Your comment, Judge Garland, was absolutely correct. There is no holding by this court. There is no holding by the United States Supreme Court. There is no holding by any circuit court of appeals that applies the Anti-Injunction Act to bar a suit on jurisdictional grounds where it does not affect the collection and or assessment or collection of taxes. Investment annuity, in that case, this
Are
court.
Are you aware of any APA case involving a freestanding challenge to an IRS refund regulation?
I am not. I think that we are in a unique situation here. It's very rare for the government to come out with its hands up and say we've been wrong all these years and have $13 billion.
No, but there could be regulations that the IRS adopts all the time.
Oh, sure. No, there certainly could be hypothetically, Your Honor, and I'm not saying there are no such cases.
But it seems like the case law does not reflect a lot of direct APA challenges to IRS tax regs.
That's correct,
Your Honor. In fact, you have to scour the books to find any.
Your Honor, if you find any, you'll find one more than I have. And I think the reason for that is...
The reason for that is the Anti-Injunction Act and maybe 7422. I don't know.
Well, I think that the IRS regulations, when they are challenged, that challenge typically does, by the nature of the IRS, impact the collection and assessment of taxes, which implicates the Anti-Injunction Act. We are in a situation now where, as in food service, it does not. So... That's the.
Now let me. That was number one. Number two. Could you answer the somewhat embarrassing point that your opponent made at relating to a statement at JA-234 that the form letter neither granted the claim nor denied it?
Your Honor, that was a reporter's paraphrase of something I had said, and or something he thought I had said, and the. I think that the.
Do you agree that it did not either grant the claim or deny it?
I do not agree with that, Your Honor.
So
I think
you're saying the reporter misparaphrased.
I'm saying either I misspoke or he got it wrong. But I think A, it did tell him you're not getting your money, which is a denial. But B, even if it didn't tell him that and just said we're not processing your claim, that was enough to trigger the right to sue. The very argument the government has made here, we might have changed our mind later on, was the argument that was rejected expressly in Register Publishing, where Judge Timbers said, you only need one decision to trigger the right to sue. You don't need two, and you don't need to sit around and wait to see if the government will change its mind, even if it says, as it did in Register Publishing, this is just a proposed disallowance and we might change our mind later on.
All right, we have your argument. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under submission.